Hi, my name is Lena Försch, and I have been in love with improvised theater for more than half my life. In the past couple of months, or really even years, improv and I went through a rough patch, and I decided to seek some outside help. So I talked to improvisers from around the globe to help me with my situation. And actually, I think I've made up with improv, which is really great, and which makes this the final episode of this podcast, Making Up with Improv. And in this final episode, I am super happy to be talking to Patty Styles from Melbourne and Joe Bill from Chicago. Both of them have been around for a really long time. They have so many interesting things to share. And so I was just super excited to be talking to them. Here's the thing about Patty and Joe. Patty had been a student with Keith Johnstone and Joe with Del Close. So one might say they come from opposite schools of improv. They have a show that's called Our Play, in which they basically say, it really doesn't matter where you come from, as long as you're happy to improvise with each other. At least that's my take from it. Have fun with the episode, you guys.
Not to just hijack your agenda, but I am interested in Patty's thoughts kind of relative to what I was saying, and like, well, what is, you know, what is even funnier? Where
it really is a fascinating question, because a lot of comedy is based on common experiences, right? So if you're doing a scene about a first date, there's the common experience in the audience of flirting, dating, meeting, the awkwardness of that, the joy of that, the things you say wrong, the time you dribble the coffee on your blouse and you're trying to hide it. All of these are common experiences. So we can find the humor in it, right? Because it's there. But now in this time and place where we have these drastic sides, and everyone's, you either think this or that, where we're becoming so polarized that what are the common, right? So if we try to do a political scene, what's the common framework for making fun of politics right now, with right-wing becoming more right-wing and left-wing becoming more left-wing, and how both those factions are viewing humanity in need, where's the common ground? So can I make fun of something there without offending someone? And then is comedy always without offense? You know, it kind of makes me reflect back on stuff we have been doing and going, hang on, was I just naive? But it does feel more and more harder to find common ground. And maybe that's why the artist's voice or the comedian's voice is really important right now, is that we need to find that common ground to bring people back to a place of us being human. Let's have a reality check on the things that we share instead of constantly splashing around in the pond of why we're different. Can we get back to when you walk down the street and trip over your shoelace that's in front of the person you adore the most? That's embarrassing. We all know that. Can we get back to that? I would say yes, but I don't know when.
I think in the human experience, the move is to try to homogenize things into this side or that side, or into homogenize, like, all pain is the same homogenous pain. All suffering is the same homogenous suffering. All oppression is the same homogenous oppression. And they're not. The humanity is in the variety of ways the human experience processes pain, processes inequity, processes these things. But the way, to me, I feel like the humor is waiting to happen is in all of us dealing with how we're coping with things that are very heavy in the world right now. Yeah. And that the challenge to us finding humor and shedding light on that together is this mindset that would be in our audience, to what degree I don't know yet, of it's either A or B. It's either A or B, where the humor is like, oh, this is my experience. I don't have the same relationship to this big topic that you do, even though you look like me, or even though you're from a similar place as me. And so on the one hand, I feel like eventually I want to make up with improv that's just silly to be silly. Mm. But I'm just not ready to do that yet because I feel like it would be not authentic. And there's this bigger, deeper thing that is uniquely mine. And I recognize that's just my relationship with improv and impro. That's what I want to do with it. And I accept any, you know, I don't begrudge anyone that wants to have fun or do puppet shows or, you know. And so I accept all of that too. But it's, for me, I think it goes to what Patty was saying, is like, what is my responsibility as an individual artist in how I want to just take these small steps initially going forward to see who I am as an artist in these times and who is the audience that I am for in these times. Mm. Because it's everything is one day at a time, everything is one step at a time, and I don't know how you flip a switch so that we're 3 years ago and we're all running on this adrenaline of like, let's go to the next place, let's go to the next place.
There's also going to be a chunk of time of needing to accept and process what we've been in. So, you know, when I think back to the early days of Impro Joe, you remember those early days back before these kids were even born? You know, there'd be common things you'd do on stage. For example, you know, you'd use a telephone. You know, you'd mime a telephone that had a cord. It was attached to another thing that was attached to the wall. And there'd be that zhink, digga, 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 zhink, digga, 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 because that was a common sound. And you did that, and everybody in the room knew that sound. And that would make people laugh. Or you do the twirling the cord like twirling your hair, because everybody knew when you were on the phone, you would play with the cord, because there's this big dangly, stringy, bouncy thing. And if you were nervous, you'd have your finger wound up in the cord. And if you were really excited, you might be turning around and suddenly realize you're wrapped in the cord. So there was things that you could do. What will those be of the Zoom world, of the working at home world, of the dealing with kids while being at home, or dealing with being alone while being at home, or looking out across a balcony and your only conversation is morning coffee, looking around a courtyard to someone across that maybe you didn't know before, and now suddenly for a year they become your morning buddy and you become best friends. So there's a lot of stories in there that will be an opportunity to look at what we've lived through and have a laugh and a release and a process. But we still haven't found what are those common themes, because we're still struggling with the loss and the fear and the change and the drama, the human loss. We're still in the pandemic, and we've got other factors that we're dealing with as well. So it's hard to imagine that we can be in a place where we're finding the joy in everybody going out on in front of their houses and applauding for the frontline workers, and a love affair happening between two neighbors across the street every night at 6 o'clock when they go out to applaud the frontline workers. They see each other, you know, and they start choosing different clothes to go out and to clap, and they start preparing for that moment every day, and that's the thing they look forward to. So there will be stories, there will be joys, there will be comedy. Are we in the place to do that yet, as you said, Joe, as we're processing what we've lived through?
So I have a question, because what you say, Patty, if I understand you correctly, is like, you know, we need to process first and then we will find a way to laugh about things again. And then, Joe, if I understand you correctly, it's more like maybe the comedy is the processing of things.
I mean, yeah,
that's our play.
Which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
which comes first, the story or the process? Yeah. I mean, they're concurrent, yeah, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is the challenge of the artist, that the audience comes to the show when they're ready, right?
Yep.
But the artist, while we're doing our personal processing, which is our own, and it's what we do in our human work, when we're on stage, we're trying to find the common themes. We're trying to find the common themes for story or comedy. So regardless of where we are in our processing, when we're on stage, we're also trying to find that common place of humanity for the audience. So we are kind of the answer to the chicken and the egg. We're in the middle. We're doing it both at the same time.
That's right. And before the pandemic, we were doing that by touching a lot of people in a lot of places on the move, and we're in contact with people. Yeah. We have that knowledge from living, touching, feeling, breathing. And now we're the same people, but we're different people because the question, part of the question is, well, who am I now? I'm not the same person as I was 2 years ago. And now my sense of how can I shed light on the human experience is based in an absence of contact with the human experience. So I'm just left to guess. And I suspect, I mean, I've lived long enough to know, and I've done enough little projects within this to know, oh, everybody's in the same place. Mm. But I know that they're not exactly in the same place. I know that there's a place of deficit and grief and longing and absence and loss. But it almost feels like more weighty or more presumptive to walk on stage with that knowledge. Mm. I mean, the way we relate to each other coming from a place of deficit, in a way it's like, you know, how do two people even who know each other well, who've both been captured by different armies, held in solitary confinement, and then re-meet for lunch, how do they go about having lunch without, like, touching on some exchange or sharing of what was my experience, what was your experience, what was my, and because this is a once-in-a-lifetime proposition, like, you rely on the closeness you had before that solitary confinement, but what you might uncover could be much more dramatic, much more emotion invoking, much more.
Do you realize in what you just said, Joe, you almost broke out into a Journey song? Living, touching, feeling, breathing. No. Very close. As you were doing it, I was going, wait, also, within what you just said, the trust factor is so massively important in what we do in improvisation, right? And improvisers know that, and there's a lot of assumptions made on trust. So, and trust needs to be nurtured, trust needs to be earned. And you can say to a group of students or a group of performers, trust each other. But telling a group of strangers to trust each other is an intellectual concept. It's got to be nurtured and grown, you know. So when Joe and I step on stage with each other, we have this trust with each other, which has been built over our friendship and the years of working together and knowing each other and, you know, having phone calls and chats and you know, sharing who we are as people with each other. So in this time of being divided, you know, and this kind of world impro, you know, people being in isolation, the trust factor is going to be an interesting one when we come back into the space. Because people are going to have had their own fear factors and dealing with whatever life has brought them in these last years. I think it's also going to show where there was fake trust, where people were pretending trust, but there wasn't trust.
What do you mean by that?
I will see a group perform, and in watching them perform, I see there isn't trust. There's an agreement to work together, but an agreement to work together in trust is different. And I can see it in how they're navigating individual safety, either by the things that they choose not to do or the things that they will block and avoid doing. The content, and I'm not just talking about like scenes that matter content, even just playing a vulnerable character in a comedy scene. The shields are up at all times. Do not make fun of me. Do not put me under the comedy bus. Do not set me up for your joke. Do not, like, you can see the factors at play. But they've agreed to work alongside each other. So they say, I got your back, but they don't.
I would just add that, or I would offer up I think trust is also not a homogenous proposition. Mm. Like, I think there's levels and degrees of trust. Mm. I think I love your point. We've agreed that we'll work together for the show that's been assembled, but whatever, like even in Zoom, how much trust does it take? And I've always, you know, kind of come from the school of, I have to trust myself first. I have to trust myself first to deal with you. And deal with you doesn't mean, deal with you might be like, oh, I have to deal with you. Or like, I have to, like, what can I, how can I deal with what you give me so I'm in support and giving you something back?
Yeah.
So like, I think there's layers of trust. And I think our relationship grew fairly quickly just because the nature of what we do is we're like, well, what does it feel like? What does it feel like the stage wants tonight? Let's do that. And we've not played together so much that we've done everything before, but we've done quote unquote anything every time.
Mm.
It's like we've done whatever it is every time. And so I think that there's people that trust themselves to get through an experience by agreeing to play with other people. And then if it's like a Zoom context or something, which I, you know, have my own thoughts about, they can always just click a button and leave the screen.
Yeah.
And when people are, even though I do agree it's a great thing that people from all over the world can get on a screen and quote unquote play together, to me, it's a human puppet show, and there's only so much depth that you can really expect to get out of that. Because when Patty was talking, I realized like the people that I trust most or look forward to being on stage with the most after this are people that I've had contact with during the pandemic. And the answer to how you doing is like, I'm not doing so good. I'm having a little rough ride today. And that's been a handful. That's been maybe five people. Mm. But we do. We check on each other. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, even if it's like, yeah, shit day, shit week, there's something about that that makes me especially look forward to meeting with those people who we've shared. It's been a fucking rough day.
Mm. That makes sense. I do have a follow-up question for you, Patty. So do you think that... Because you were saying that now that we're going back in, like, to performing together, you can see that there was fake trust before. Why can you see that now? I didn't quite get that. Like, what's the difference now?
I've seen the fake trust for a long time. I've seen it for a long time. And look, agreeing to work with someone is a level of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's not devoid of all trust, but there is a different type of trust. If you're dating mm-hmm. someone, when you agree to go on that first date, there is a level of trust you're giving that other person that I'm going to share this time and experience with you. But that's not the same type of trust as calling that person at 3 o'clock in the morning because that day you got bad news from your doctor and you need someone. And you need someone who's going to drop everything and come over to your house right now, no questions asked, that they will sit with you when you cry and they will hold you without asking or projecting. So those are the different levels of trust I'm kind of talking about. And as artists, for us to get to content, be it comedic or dramatic, but content that is truly authentic in the moment, that's truly coming from where we're at, that's reflecting the stage that we're on, the audience that we're in front of, the environment of the world that we're currently living in, I'm going to call those people that I would call at 3 o'clock in the morning. Because those are the people that I know I can bear my soul to if that's required. That I can play an unsavory character if that's required. Because I know that they're not judging me. They're not projecting that on me. They know Patty's making a character choice relevant to the scene that's needed now.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's that depth of trust. And that's the kind of trust that's earned. And it's earned in how, and this is a beautiful expression of Joe, being in service to your fellow improviser. So how have I developed my trust in Joe? It's because when I walk on stage, the way he looks at me, the way he hears me, the way he witnesses with me, the way he plays off and with, beside, under, around. Like, it's knowing that I can extend in any direction and he is with me fully in that moment. And if I extend in a direction and I shatter the scene, he is not going to be critical of me. Afterwards, he might go, where the hell did that come from? But that's colleagues recognizing the curiosity and having a reflective place of our work. He is not going to judge me. I also know that he will look in my eyes and see, tonight, is she fully with me, or is tonight something going on in her and she's not fully here? And if she's not fully here, my job is to look after her. And if she is fully here, my job is to open the door, push her out, and let her run around the field, which he has done on many occasions.
Likewise.
Yeah. But you don't get that with every improviser. Is that skill and craft? Partially, but I think it's more than that. I think it's a give and take between players.
I was just going to ask, because sometimes you might be the improviser who throws a fellow improviser under the bus in whichever way, because you're very uncomfortable, you might not be as experienced, there's like there's fear, you know, all those components also add to maybe not being the most trustworthy partner in a scene, right?
I was just gonna say, if that happens with less experienced people, you know, you're describing something. I think one thing that is going to happen when we come back is we're going to see degrees of purpose being expressed in improv. And that is beginning exploratory, recreational, bar prob, whatever. And so if somebody gets thrown under the bus inadvertently or just because somebody freaks out, you know, or whatever, hopefully somebody is managing that situation that can mitigate any real harm being done. But I mean, there's a difference. It's so interesting. I believe better improv happens through better relationships. And I think it was Jules Munz in London said, two-prov is it's an artistic celebration of friendship. And to me, that's a really cool idea, because Patty and I can tell where each other are, and we will absolutely push each other. We'll have degrees of mischief just depending on where we are, but I don't feel like any one of us has ever gone outside of an understanding immediately kind of where we are. And there's been a couple times I've been absolutely lost with Patty, and I can give her a look and she knows, and what I see is that she loves it, and then that makes me feel good, and it's because of our relationship. Whereas I think if people, like, on a sort of a hobbyist recreational level, if something's lost, then there's default positions that are almost like archetypes designed to get laughs that could be emotionally impactful to somebody who might not have the experience that either of us
have. This is what you just said, Joe, reminds me a bit of your book, actually, Patty, that you just but recently published, Improvise Freely, because maybe that falling into the patterns is exactly what you find is a problem, right? Like, what maybe also takes away that trust that anything goes and we will figure it out on the go, that we will fall into those patterns to sort of avoid actually improvising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I think the rules and the patterns, there's a lot of different reasons for the different rules. But what it does is it gives a false sense of security. We all agree to follow these rules, so therefore we can trust that you'll follow these rules.
So therefore we won't fail, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't guarantee that you won't fail. So right then and there, you're setting people up for a greater fall, because you're saying, follow these rules and you will be good. Follow these rules, you will be successful. This is how you improvise if you do these things. That's not necessarily true. You can do all of those things and it can be the worst possible scene ever. So then the student goes, well, but I've done everything you've told me and you've lied to me.
Yeah.
So where's the trust in that? Right? You can be on stage with someone and you've both done everything and it hasn't worked. So where do you put your confusion and blame? You can be on stage with someone and you're following the rules and they follow an inspired impulse and go somewhere else. Do you go, yay, discovery, go for it, break the rules, let's see what's happening? Or do you go, hey, you've broken the rules. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you've broken my trust because my assumption was you were going to do A, B, C, and you didn't. How dare you not do what I assumed in impro? Wait a minute. So it actually, I think, creates problems. Now, rules can be useful in a game or an exercise to create a resistance for discovery. So, for example, in the game Red Light, Green Light or Granny Steps, the rule is you don't move when I'm looking at you. Mm-hmm. And you can move when I'm not. Because the exploration in that game is how far can I move, how quickly before you catch me? So I need a rule or a resistance. Otherwise, people just run up and tag and run up and tag, and you don't have that discovery. And Viola and Keith would use rules in exercises and games to force exploration in other avenues or to take away pressure of people being right or having to be good. But what's happened is these rules have become rules of creativity, rules of performance, rules of structure, which is not what we're trying to train people to do. I was just in conversation with a fellow by the name of Andy Harmon. Do you know Andy, Joe?
I know the name.
Yeah.
Where's he from?
He's in the U.S. I don't know the city off the top of my head. But he spent a lot of time working with Viola. And he's just read my book. And he was talking about the who, what, where. And he said, you know, Viola would get angry at them when they were talking about it. She'd be like, don't talk about it. Discover it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the environment was important to discover, to find, mm-hmm. to inspire yourself. Where are we? The environment wasn't important mm-hmm. to label it verbally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So these rules have come out after the fact. These rules didn't exist originally. I'm slightly going off topic.
No. We can improvise this. We can improvise freely. It's fine. We don't have to stay on topic. There is no...
Well, and it's still related to the topic because your relationship to improv or impro is also your relationship to the rules or lack of rules, right? It's like, I don't like the way all of a sudden these rules, you know, spoken or unspoken are developing in this space. I'm breaking up with this space and I'm going to go find another space. Because the words anything goes in improv meant something different in the 70s, something different in the 80s, yes. Something different in the 90s, certainly something different today. Like anything goes as this thing has become bigger and more institutionalized and more commoditized. Like anything does not go the same way it anything goes in the 70s or 80s. Mm. And I think that, you know, we have to be aware of the times that we're in. It's really interesting that, like, especially, you know, we were talking before just about, you know, World War II and the trauma, and there's a lot of people, even 9/11, we must never forget, we must never forget, we must never forget. And so all of this is just like a mantra to always remember the injustice, the pain, and the suffering. Even that Old Testament Bible, you know, there's a wrathful, vengeful. But isn't it interesting that in all therapy, it's about releasing and letting go and not holding on to your pain. It's like the pain, there's a position for the pain and the suffering. It's like remembering, yes, but it's like, but even people's different relationship to remembering the pain they went through makes them feel, you know, we can become addicted to the perpetuation of suffering, or we can also, you know, find ourselves once we get used to suffering in a certain way, we just find different ways to suffer in the same way. And I think that's a form of addiction. And I think that's what the rules of improv do.
Yes.
here's the rules of improv. You can continue to suffer in the same way. Why? Because now you know you're doing it right. Like, it's kind of the definition of a toxic relationship.
You're always repeating the same pattern because you know it, because it's familiar.
Yeah. And in game, like in a lot of game, you are allowed to fail. You're allowed to suffer. In fact, in some forms of improv, suffering equals audience enjoyment equals audience laughter. It's even in the setup to the game. You know, come watch people suffer. When they used to do the, I forget who did this first. I think it might have happened in Australia first. But when Drew Carey used to tour the live Whose Line Is It Anyway show, the very last game, they would blindfold Drew Carey and they would put 100 mousetraps on the stage, and he would walk around in bare feet. And it was, they called the game whatever the game was called, but they said, but Ryan Stiles would say, but it's really called Watch the Millionaire Suffer. And it's literally a blindfolded guy getting his toes snapped by mousetraps, and then them getting him to put his fingers and just torturing him with mousetraps.
Yeah.
There's something about, you know, part of comedy is suffering plus time.
Interesting, yeah. Interesting but, formula.
Yeah, but it's also how you react to the suffering. And this is the difference between comedy and tragedy.
Yes.
Right? So someone walks down the street, they slip in a banana peel, they hit the ground and they bounce, or they hit the ground and they make a funny woo noise, or they do a double take of amazement and surprise, and we will laugh because it wasn't any pain. Someone walking down the street, they slip on a banana peel, they hit the ground and they scream out in pain. That triggers our sympathy and our empathy. And now we start looking at tragedy because maybe they broke a hip. But the action, the platform, the situation are exactly the same. It was the reaction to that changes the material. And that's something that, you know, in our rules of impro is comedy or impro is tragedy or drama, impro is short form or impro is long form, again, robs us of the complexity of our work, right? So, you know, people say, Harold's a long form, and I go, but, you know, and this is me being argumentative just because sometimes I like to be because it's fun. I go, do you do any group games? Yes. Isn't a group game a short form thing? Wait. Right? And I don't care if you call it long form or not. That's, in a way, fine. That's your deal. It's when people start drawing these hard lines around, it is this, it can't be that, it's never that. And I go, well, it's kind of both, you know?
Yeah. It's not homogenous. Impro's not homogenous. Mm. Dating is not homogenous.
Yeah.
Relationships are not homogenous. There's variety in there.
Yeah.
And it's, I have to throw in, really early in my journey, and I don't even remember where I learned this from, but I was taught the difference between comedy and tragedy is tragedy is I've been stabbed, and comedy is look at my wound. So I've been stabbed. The audience is to imagine themselves stabbed and go on their own journey. And then comedy is, oh, I accept that I've been wounded, and in fact, look at my wound. And now I'm in control of that. But I've always loved that.
Yeah.
And I always discovered, like, it always works for me in so many different situations. Even when I'm on stage, I'm, like, subliminally reminded of that when I have an impactful moment with someone.
Yeah. If you're stabbed and you look at it and you look up with surprise or wonder and then you put your hand in your wound, comedy. If you look at it and you look up pleading for help and worried about your mortality and grab it to survive, tragedy. Yeah. But you've done the same thing. You've looked up, you've put your hand there, but it's all the reactions and responses because, of course, being changed, that's the engine of action, right? But, you know, some of the rules rob that, right? So,
yeah.
It oversimplifies it.
Yeah, and I think that there's, Mark and I have taught this since we started touring, it's just like there's an inverse relationship between obligation and inspiration. Mm-hmm. So the more you're obliged, the less you're inspired. The more you're inspired, the less evidence of obligation there is. Mm-hmm. And I think we proved that by the first time we played together. Like, we're experienced enough that we're not obliged to what we've learned, but we know what we've learned. And now the application of what we learned is, who is this on stage with me and how can I be of service?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah.
But in those beginning years, and especially now with this inflated desire and ambition and even feeling of entitlement to be good right away, right now, and accepted as a great improviser, in that, people hang on to this obligation to like a set of rules to serve their own success. And it's, you know, we can spend years trying to help them out of that state.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you were just saying, Joe, the first time that the two of you, you and Patty, performed together, that was actually 10 years ago. You have an anniversary of that first performance, hey?
Yeah, we do. And I think it's been 11 now.
It's been 11 now.
But I think it was 2011, I think.
To be honest, I didn't, because it was in Würzburg, right? At the Würzburg Festival?
Yeah, it was in Würzburg.
I didn't double check because, you know, the year is now, it's such a long time ago, it all gets mixed up. But it's been a long time ago. And I think even back then I hadn't realized that this was the first time you performed together. What was the initial idea of our play, of the show? You didn't have one?
Well, we did.
Keep emailing.
So we first met at the Out of Bounds Festival. And there was this interesting...
Austin, Texas.
Yeah, it was this interesting setup to our meeting. So I had one of these strange moments. I got to the festival. Festival was great. Organizers were great. Like, really a lot of great things. But I just had this one moment that made me go a little sideways. And I was at the opening party, and, you know, I'm not entrenched in the American improv comedy scene. So I was a bit of a duck out of water. I knew a handful of people, and it's fine. And I had this person come up to me, and they walked up and they went, "You Patty?" And I went, "Yeah." And they went, "Oh, you're the Johnstone chick, eh?" I trained with Keith, and they honestly looked me up and down and went, "Well, we'll see what you got," and walked away.
Oh, wow.
So bizarre.
It was so bizarre, right? I thought, like, the part of me is going, if you think that, fine, that's your deal. But to actually come up, and it's like...
Also, welcome to Texas.
Yeah, I was like, what kind of throwdown is this? Are we supposed to go, when you're a jet, you know, like, what is this? Anyway, so then there was this little murmuring going around because, you know, I'd worked with Keith and Joe'd worked with Dell. And there was little murmurings of what's going to happen when these two disciples meet, right? And it was just this weird vibe thing that kind of kept happening. So at, I think it was the closing party in the karaoke joint that we were in. Because there was all those rooms. Anyway, Joe walked up to me and was just like, "You Patty?" And he's like, "Yeah, I'm Joe." I was like, "Hi, you want a drink?" "Yep." Got a 6-pack, sat down, and we chatted for 2 hours. Right? That was it, right? And we were talking about how weird it was that, because there were students that kind of kept walking by and trying to listen in on what we were talking about, or like gathering in corners and staring at us. And we were just talking about how weird that was and, you know, what it was like when we first started improvising. And if someone came to town or came to your city, you wouldn't go, "Oh, you're that person from that other place." Mm-hmm. You'd be like, "Hey, wow, so what do you do? Mm-hmm. How does it work? Let's get in the room. Let's share this."
And there were certainly existence of camps. There were certainly existence of camps where when Patty would come to the States, she would have to back out and then have to manage... You know, she was taught in a different way. And me, especially when I would go to Canada, and I mean, even as much being part of the annoyance as having studied with Dell, but you go to Canada and you don't know narrative, then like, what exactly are you here to do? And so I think part of our connection was we had immediately so much, such a feeling of connection just drinking a beer together. We quickly came upon like, well, how can we make each other's lives easier when we go into the other camps and then eventually destroy the idea of camps?
Yeah.
Sounds like a very good mission.
Yeah, and that's kind of where our play came from. And that's actually the blurb in Würzburg for our play was, you know, Patty's worked with Keith, Joe's worked with Del. Can they work together? And it was like it sold out in an audience of improvisers. And we were going, really? Improvisers, really? Really? This is a... Okay, fine. You know, like, it was just weird.
And we wouldn't talk about what we would do. We would trade Del stories and Keith stories and then, like, talk about food or something. And then it was, you know, the one thing I knew this... I had a feeling the show was going to be fine anyway. But when Patty and I were in what was supposed to be tech rehearsal sitting on the stage, I think she was showing me one of Keith's comic books, and then the news crew from Würzburg comes walking into the room, and then Patty and I immediately changed into two characters that would be on TV interviewed by a news crew without, we just became those people. It's like, oh yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and we did this interview and she's like, can we see you work? Well, actually we're doing the behind the scenes, some shit that we made up. And then they, you know, we gave them what they needed to capture on film and like, we'll see you tonight. And then they left and then we laughed and it was, and I think it was just like, oh, I think the show's going to be fine. And we didn't really decide what to do till maybe 10 or 15 minutes or maybe like right at the end. It was like, well, maybe this, maybe that. And then a few minutes, like 15 minutes maybe before the show, let's take a song. Is that how you remember
it? What I remember is the only decision we made was the first half you were going to give me a Del experience and the second half I was going to give you a Keith experience. But we didn't define what that meant.
Yeah. And so then we took a song. The title of the song was the title of our play. That song itself was the lead-in music. It started off in the dark. And at the end of 52 minutes, we had done a perfect two-person Harold that was also a perfect two-person narrative. And then we went out, and then Patty beat the shit out of me with some dusty pillows. And I think we did it.
Yeah. What was interesting in the break was because the shows before us ran late, so the time slot that we had, because I think we had a two-hour time slot because we were going to go two halves, we didn't have that time. So we did the first half, and then at intermission, it was clear that the second half was only going to be like a 20 minute or a
25, something.
So, you know, we had the Del experience, and then I was like, oh, the thing I was thinking of trying on Joe for the Keith experience, I can't really do now because we've only got 20 minutes. So, what am I going to do? And some of the stuff we had done in the first half was so in sync with Keith experience anyway, because character story, connection, being changed, looking after each other. I was like, okay, we'll do some exercises. I'm pretty sure Del wouldn't have beaten you with a pillow or a pool noodle, so let's try that.
Yeah, you just said you want to play some Keith games. I'm like, yeah, sure, let's do that.
Yeah.
And I think what I later... Like, I think an important realization later, like, even though this is our introduction, it was the context that the improv nerds were really interested in seeing what's going to happen. We didn't do a Del thing or a Keith thing. We did a Patty and Joe thing. And so, you know, even those of us that are heavily influenced by the people that come before us, and I certainly am I'm as influenced by Del as I am by Annoyance, and now by Keith because of the people that I've worked with, not really taking the, you know, I was afforded the opportunity, the privilege to play with all these brilliant people that came up in Keith world. It's like, oh, I get it now. But, you know, Patty and I are Patty or Patty and I, and the people that study under us will be the people that study under us. And how great we got to study with these crazy geniuses, or that I got to live a crazy decade in Annoyance, and Patty has the Moose experience and the Impro Melbourne experience, and you know, our brains are all collections of the experiences that we've had up to the point where our brains come together that night to do that thing that we're going to do, and. You know, I wish there was some way we could bottle experience and just have students drink it before they take a workshop, but then maybe we wouldn't have any work to do.
Yeah.
What a great concept. Just have a bottle of experience before. But, I mean, you know, having the experience is the fun.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was just thinking of that, our, you know, tech rehearsal and talking to the film crew. Something I don't think I was consciously aware of till now was when we sat down in our tech rehearsal to work out our show, the fact that you were relaxed, that it was more about getting to know me, that you didn't come in with your CV like, here's the stuff I've done, here's the stuff we could do, here's this, right? There wasn't agenda, there was connection. There wasn't panic or fear about, let's make it work and it's got to be good. It was, hey, it all starts with getting to know you. All of that was so in line with how I work and how I worked at the Moose, right? That experience that it did transcend beyond Dell and Keith, and yet still honored them because, you know, Dell would say, okay, what's in the news? Well, that's connecting people to what's the experience now. It's not, right, today in class we're going to achieve these four things and this is what we're going to do. It's start with, who are we today? Mm-hmm. You know, and Keith is very much the same way. He walks into a room and he kind of looks at where everybody's at. What's the energy? What's the feeling? What's going on? Let's start here and see where it evolves. And that was both in our bones of how we work. Right? But through that, we were building trust. And the trust was being earned because you were telling me stories about you. You were sharing yourself with me. And I was sharing myself with you. I wasn't sharing with you my credits. I wasn't sharing with you my accolades. I wasn't trying to impress you with the great things I could do, which someone should tell me what they are because I don't know them. I was simply going, hey, human being, I'm going to be playing with you tonight. Yep. So, who are you?
Yep. It's so funny. I mean, I'm extremely relationship driven, you know, which is very me. And it's even more me than it is Annoyance or Dell. But there was the local American Football Club hired a bunch of new, like a new head coach, a new general manager and coaches and whatever. They're talking about their philosophy. And I love the Chicago Bears, and so I was listening to them talk, and I'm always like, well, okay, where, you know, who's going to speak the philosophy that aligns with improv? And one of them did, and it speaks to this exact thing when they're talking about building a culture, you know, of winning and all the other stuff. But he gave this equation: rules without relationship equals rebellion. And I think that's true in a group, and I think that's true in an individual's head. And so if you have rules without a good relationship, which is who am I, how am I right here, do I feel safe, do I feel connected, then there will be rebellion in here. And if I, you know, my way to work is, hey, how you doing? You know, what's our CV? Well, we drank beers together in Austin. That seems like enough. if we have relationship, I can tell you I got your back, but to me, those words really don't mean much if we haven't sat and had a, you know, how you doing?
Yeah.
What I need most before I walk on stage with anybody is to be able to look into their eyes, and 99 times out of 100, I got it, and I think they got me.
Yeah. I remember when I was in Dubai and I was directing a maestro, I remember that before the show, I was sitting in the first row waiting for them to come out, and I heard there was like so much sound and noise in the background, and they were playing warm-up games. I've never experienced anything like that before. When they ran on stage, I thought it was like a bunch of, I don't even know what, like monkeys, but not in the way that they were like playful, but in the way that I thought they were gonna like just not stop running until they've, you know, trampled down the audience. They were just so crazy. And I thought maybe it would have been good for people to just, you know, not play the crazy games, but to just sit down with each other and, you know, have like a, have a fun conversation, you know, just have a conversation and ask each other how they're doing. Because I think if people want to play warm-up games, that's fine. But sometimes I feel like they're actually bringing people out of contact a little bit beforehand because they're, you know, you're getting all psyched, which can be good if you may, you know, might feel a little bit shy or some, you know, or tired even, that, you know, but oftentimes it also just makes you hyper and not really in contact with other people.
It's it's interesting how improvisers feel and maybe it's performing artists in general, but I see it more in the improv community. It's like they're preparing for battle going out on stage. And these warm-up games are, you know, it's like warriors pounding their chests and putting on their shields and building up all their adrenaline to go out and fight the mighty dragon. No, we're going out to have a nice time and build a relationship and connection. So if you're in battle mode, where's your head? Where's your heart? Where's your body? Where's your breath? Because I don't think it's with each other. I don't think it's, that's not building group mind.
And to think that people, to think that everybody needs the same thing to warm up, yeah. I think is silly.
Yeah.
But you might as well start with, what are we doing tonight? And if we're doing a maestro, in my opinion, and now this is just opinions, but that to find an energy that is going to be of service to a game show that also has theatrical airs to it is probably going to be better than Screaming Monkeys. But if you're doing an American short form comedy sports show, not in every market, but in some, the you know, that's about adrenaline and it's comedy sports. You will see comedy, you will get sports, there will be adrenaline. Nothing is sacred. Losing is part of the deal. You know, there's all of these rules and it is like it's so American. But the people that do it well, they can go 1,000 miles an hour or they can go 1 mile an hour. And that's maybe 10% of them.
Yeah.
But that helps, you know, that's an approach that I can do, but it's that a bunch of screaming monkeys might be okay for that before a show like that.
Mm.
And this is, you know, in a way... One of the things I love most about traveling out of America is getting away from that exact sensibility. You know, and not everybody plays like that, but it is, I really love different people from different places sharing different warm-ups. But I wish there was more conversation about what is the show that we're doing tonight. And even if none of us has done that, like even just like imagining what this show is, so we get the idea of who are the components that are going to, we're going to be drawing this show out of. Like, I hope that's something that we see.
Yeah.
Because for me, I would just rather look in somebody's eyes and then listen to music.
Yeah. You know, useful things, I think, you know, pre-show is definitely, you know, what's the show about? Just like, you know, kind of what's the framework of what are we aiming to achieve in this show?
What's the tone?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there a subject material we're trying to approach or not approach? Is our objective laughs? Is our objective exploration? Is our objective exploration and we hope for laughs? Is our objective so laughs, don't worry about exploration? Is our objective telling stories about, you know, people and truth and truthful situations? Are we doing something fantastical, something genre, something musical? Is it anything goes? Or is it, no, stay very focused on this point? Whatever. Like, that's the joy of creating, right? So we get that little framework. Ah, great. You know, we are doing, you know, that. Wonderful. You know, having a chance to look at the lights, I think, is really useful in a warm-up. If you're not used to performing on that space, have the lights come up. Walk around on the stage. Prep yourself so you know the tools at your disposal. Go stand in the back row of the audience to see what the audience's visual to the stage is like. Move around where the audience is sitting so that when you're on stage creating a stage picture, you know what you're creating. Like, gather the toys in your toy box so that when you're out there to play, it's available. Warm up your voice, whatever that is. For some people, it's singing. For some people, it's gentle humming quietly in the corner while they're listening to music, whatever it is. Stretching, because you just need to get oxygen to your muscles. Right? So that your body's available. If you need to jump up and down while doing that, fine. Maybe you need it one night and not the next. And if there are warm-up games, if there are some people that are having a, you know, a kind of a funky, slow day and they need a little bit of adrenaline, then they should do that. but the expectation that everybody should do that is unfair, because that's mm-hmm. not, everybody doesn't need the same thing. So give space for people to do what they need to do.
I think it's, but it's also a matter of finding out what it is that you need to do, no? Because I don't feel like, I don't feel like people feel forced to do those warm-up games. It's just like, that's how you do it, right? Like, that's what happens before a show. So you also need to find out what it is that you,
oh, is
actually
it a
need to
is
do.
Is it a pattern?
I think it might be.
Yeah. It absolutely is. I have been judged harshly in shows because they go, time for a warm-up, and everybody takes the obligatory position in a circle. like obedient cattle, you know, or sheep going to be sheared. Warm-up, everybody forms a circle. And I'm like, you know, and they're like, okay, let's play this game. And I'm like, great. I would really prefer to do my own warm-up if you don't mind. And I've actually had people go, like, I've got the judgment eyes, the sound. I've had one person mm-hmm. say, no, everybody has to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm like, okay, my choice here is to either argue with you, which is not going to be a good start to the show. I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. I'll step in. But the fact that you needed to control the situation instead of recognize that one of your performers, who's, you know, I've got a little bit of experience, I need to do something other.
Mm-hmm.
And you've now put me into an us or them situation, which I was trying to avoid by just being respectful and saying what I need. So you didn't hear my need.
Mm-hmm.
Your need to control trumped my need of how I warm up. Now I'm in a false space where I have to pretend that this particular game that you're playing, which is not a favorite game of mine to start with, I have to pretend it's okay because now everybody's watching for my reaction. Like, it just... just play your thing. Let me stretch. Just let me stretch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's and I think, and especially, you know, now we're just back to the trauma of these last 2 years, and also the lessons we've learned along the way, just about accessibility issues and what do you need to feel invited, what do you need to feel safe, what do you need to feel accepted, because the group is not just as strong as the sum of its parts, but it's as strong as the relationship of the sum of its parts. And so, you know, I have a feeling that warm-ups are going to be an interesting, I think there's going to be some new types of warm-ups and check-ins and stuff that are going to evolve even more quickly than maybe what we see on stage. But it's, you know, I think the counter to you, Patty, is like, I am legendary for hating the warm-up bunny. I hate it. I absolutely hate it. I see no sense in it. But I do trust that some people feel warmed up by it. And because I was so outspoken and couldn't just shut my mouth, the fun thing then is to make me do bunny bunny. But I also know for me, as long as they give me time after bunny bunny, I can flip a switch. I can love bunny bunny for the amount of time it takes to play bunny bunny. And then bunny bunny can end. And then I can go listen to, you know, rap or something. I can go put Eminem in my ears or put some Snoop Dogg in my ears and just like that. And at least then I know that whatever, if I'm playing with a bunch of people that love bunny bunny, I know I'm not going to be completely in my comfort zone or wheelhouse. So let me just have a taste of that for a second. Mm. And that's my personal choice.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm just throwing that into the pot. I don't think anybody should be made to do any
Nobody should be made to play bunny bunny.
No, it's no.
Or world's worst.
No.
I like it. I like bunny bunny.
Sure. Love that you love it. I love that you love it.
But that's it. It's like when you said, a component of all its parts. What was it? The sum of all its pieces.
The whole is not equal to the sum of its parts. The whole is equal to the relationship of the sum of all of its parts.
Absolutely.
So,
and all of those parts are individual.
That's right.
And
that's right.
There seems to be this illusion that if we're improvisers, we're all the same.
Yeah.
Which is robbing our stage of individuality. And
that's right.
And this has been a real problem across the board for everybody, but in particular when we look at inclusivity. If we're just assuming everybody is equal, we're not recognizing the beautiful diversity that we have, right? Mm-hmm. So we assume everyone is equal, but we are all who we are individually, mm-hmm. right?
And it's okay, no matter who you are, if you've grown up in a homogenous environment of one specific demographic and that's been your experience all your life, and you're just early into the idea that look at all the different types of people and upbringings and sensibilities and cultures there are in the world, you are forgiven if that's uncomfortable for you and you're not going to be an expert in harmonizing with everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. And give people space to be where they're at. You know, so some people will enjoy Bunny Bunny. Fantastic. And in that joy, in that play, you're putting yourself into a playful place and you're connecting and you're feeling the joy of something that you like. Beautiful. Other people despise Bunny Bunny. Now, Joe makes the choice to step into it, so he finds his way in. But on other nights, maybe he can't find that way in. Maybe something's happened that day, something's going on in his world, and he needs just a little bit more Snoop Dogg, right? So yep. For everybody to go, well, if you don't do this, then you're not one of us, is like, whoa, wait, hang on, back up on the cult thing. Let people be where they are. Let people prep as they need to. You know, I know some people who need to meditate. I need some people who need to go for a run. I know some people who need to do really animated things. I know some people who need to sit and write. Some people who listen. Like, there are so many ways of warming up. And people might use different things different nights. But that, it's like, our first offer is our partner. And if we can't be present with the individuality and the truth of where our partner and partners are at, before we even walk out on stage, if we are already in a place of, I expect you to do what I want you to do so I feel comfortable. I expect you to be obedient to a process that doesn't serve you. I expect you to adjust yourself to fit my norm. Listen to what we're actually putting on our partner before we get out in front of an audience and then have the pressures of performance.
Mm-hmm.
When it's so easy to say, yeah, do your thing.
But it is what you just said. No, it can be, it can have that cult quality. I don't know if you know that show BoJack Horseman. Have you seen that one on Netflix?
I've seen like, yeah, 3 or 4 episodes. I don't really get it.
Oh, I really love it. I think it's a great show. You should try it again and watch until season two, where they have the Yes End episode. Mm-hmm. And it's literally one guy like needs to find some kind of purpose, and he sees one door that says, I think that's BoJack Horseman, that says Scientology, and the next door says improv, and he just, you know, decides to go into improv, and then he gets like sucked into this cult, and you know, they end up on a cruise, and it's like Yes End is the philosophy, and there's, you know, nothing you can't say anything against it, and they have to escape because it gets too crazy, and it can have that. Maybe not as extreme, but it can have that quality. And I guess it's all about, like, you want to make things predictable for yourself. You want to make things feel less dangerous. You want to make... I remember, like, in my early 20s, when I was, like, struggling with life, I would always wonder, like, what is the one thing that I need to learn to find happiness? What is the one thing that's always true? And it turns out, that thing doesn't exist, I think, in my early 30s. Maybe it does, but no, I think it doesn't. And that's a difficult truth to accept. But it comes back to what you said before, Joe, about, like, can we have that space in our minds where many things are true at the same time? And I love, for instance, like, Keith's approach where he teaches a thing, like one specific skill in a certain way, and then he does the opposite afterwards, and people go, but that doesn't make any sense. Like, how can I, that it doesn't make any sense, but maybe that's not even the point. Maybe the point is that it doesn't make any sense, and it works like it works differently each time, mm-hmm. and you can have experience, but you can never know what works at the end of the day.
Well, the point is experience. The point is question. Yeah. The point is curiosity. The point is don't follow something blindly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to kind of come back to your original context for this podcast, Lena, is this about, you know, breaking up or getting back together mm-hmm. with improv? It seems like if you think about relationships, when we break up and you look back, it's like, where did this go wrong? Mm. At some point, there was a fear that was introduced into one or both people. And then that fear is not communicated, it's not quelled, it's not treated, and the fear grows, and the fear grows, and the fear grows. And there's no resolution to the fear, and so the breakup has to happen, or it becomes a toxic relationship, or the fear of leaving and the unknown is greater than the fear of staying in this oppressive fucking thing. And so for me, the purpose of warm-ups and why I look in people's eyes is like, boy, I hope we can get you, even if you're fearful walking in here and you're doing this as a courageous act. My hope is that you can feel less fearful or maybe eliminate the fear just by knowing I'm there and there might be other people. And if you can't and you're still taking your fear on stage with you, then this warm up is about you knowing that I'm okay with your fear and come do the first scene with me and let's just see. Because you're probably afraid of failing. And if you see that I'm willing to fail with you, then in my opinion, that's the best any improv teacher can do.
Yeah.
And that's walk into it with you.
Absolutely. You know, if although I'm not a big fan of warm-up games, if I'm working with a group and I can sense that there's a lot of fear and the warm-up game is a way of them expending, you know, or expunging some of that fear, I'll join in. Because it's serving a purpose and I see that purpose. And that purpose is important to my, you know, fellow partners. If the warm-up game is about being clever, it's about, you know, I got to be quick. Well, okay, that's what you need to work on right now. I don't need to work on that. If it's about removing a group fear, yeah, we all need to work on that. I get mm-hmm. that, right? And if part of your warm-up before a show is to run around slapping each other on the back saying, I've got your back, couple of tips. Look your partner in the eye. Don't just run by them and hit them. Hitting someone and saying, I've got your back, is not an example of got your back. It's an example of I've ignored you. I haven't seen you. I've just physically hit you. And I'm doing what I was told so that I achieve this.
Mm-hmm.
Take a moment and look at your partner. I've got your back means I'm supporting you. I'm with you. We're doing this together. You can step off the cliff into the unknown, and I am with you. I will support the failures, and I will celebrate your success. It's not, I'm going to whack you on the back and not look at you. So if you genuinely mean, I've got your back, take a moment to let your partner know you genuinely mean, I've got your back, and that you genuinely look in their eyes, and you genuinely see them and connect with them. Trust is earned and trust is built. That's a moment you can do it. Take that beautiful, precious moment.
I feel like we should just, you know, cut here. That's a perfect ending. But I just
and launch the balloons.
But I actually wanted to ask you, both of you, like, if there ever was a time when you needed to make up with improv, was there ever a time when you said, I'm done with this? I'm not returning, but then somehow found your way back.
The closest thing for me is when I first moved to Chicago, I was doing both stand-up and improv. And I did not know what a mess I was. And my purpose for doing stand-up was to become a better writer. So I could understand maybe what a scene was about better in an improv sense. But then maybe I don't need this improv stuff because I was always just piling too much shit into an improv scene instead of understanding what it's about. But the real driver for me to do stand-up was the thought, well, I could pay a therapist to listen to all this, or I can write this all down, turn it into jokes, and make an audience laugh and make money mm-hmm. sharing this. And when I realized that I'm not a stand-up, I'm an entertainer, that's one of the things I am, but that I, the last years of stand-up, the more miserable my life was, the funnier I was on stage, and I never didn't kill. And I could absolutely see in my last 2 years of stand-up how people end up dead doing stand-up who don't get a therapist. And so for me, it was less about leaving improv. It was about more going down this thing. And in the back of my head, maybe if I do this, I could get better at this thing that I could do as a hobby someday. When it turned out that one of the foundational pieces of damage to me was I didn't, I was taught as a kid to not trust. I wasn't taught to trust. And I was taught to not trust so that I needed to get into therapy so I could learn to trust myself, so I could learn to trust others. And it just so happened that I was part of a theater that was also a lot of fucking chaos and fucked up crazy energy in the 90s. But there was people at that theater that were just as fucked up as I was. And we all, in our really weird way, ended up making impactful shows. Some good impactful and some awful, like some of the worst shit you've ever seen in your life. But we were all still there for each other in all of our sick, weird ways. And in a way, that to me was getting back together with improv, was the annoyance experience. And in doing that, my improv life really started when I started doing Bass Prov with Mark, and it's just two guys sitting in a boat sharing their feelings, essentially. So that's the closest thing to what you've asked that I can come up with.
I think for me, whenever, you know, the thought has come to mind, like, am I done with this? I get sad. Because it's like, well, am I done with curiosity? Am I done with play? Am I done with discovery? Am I done with wonder? Am I done with joy? Am I done with this beautiful connection with people in this act of creation? No. I never want to be done with that. I get sad at the thought that one day maybe it will have to pause, right? And I say pause because I'm like, there's got to be, you know,
I'm not going to. Where's the door? Where's the trap door?
I'm not going to accept the fact. You know, I'll be in some, you know, seniors home 97 with an impro group, right? but when I feel that I'm asking that question, am I done? My fatigue or my pain or my disillusionment or my disconnect, whatever that word is, comes from what's being created, what's being shared, what's happening in the community, what's happening on our stages, the limitations on our work, sometimes the frustrations I feel where I feel I'm an oddball in the improv world, that it feels like the majority of the improvisers want one thing and I'm in a different area wanting something other. And also just the burden, the challenges that we have as artists to even be able to begin to create an environment for us to create. The finding a venue, the renting a venue, the gathering people together, the trying to get people into a shared space to create this thing. That is when I start questioning, do I step away? But then when I think about that, it's like I'm breaking up with something I love because the world has made it hard. So do I give over to the world letting it be hard? Or do I raise up my stubborn side and say, nah, this is important to me. It's important to the world. I love it. Okay, hard is part of the journey. Here we go. And I've still got enough stubbornness and fight in me for that.
Okay, now that has to be the ending now. Not that, that really has to be okay.
For
let's
sure.
Just stop it right there.
The balloons are already launched, so.
Thank you guys so much for talking to me, for making time to be on the podcast.
It's been, so good to see you, Lena.
It's been really great to see you and reconnect.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to see your face.
And I've already got one trip back to Europe on the books. I don't think Germany this first trip, but for sure, as long as there's not another variant ready to kill everybody, I could see at least a second trip, and I think Germany would be part of that.
Nice.
Even if it's just Berlin, I'll let you know.
Yes.
Are you in Würzburg now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Würzburg. Okay. Yeah.
And we are trying. We are trying next year to do the Our Play 10th anniversary 2 years late tour.
Yes.
I mean, that just rolls off the tongue.
Doesn't
you should
it
do it.
Yep.
There's all these bands that are, that are doing endless tours, which is their final tour. And we're still trying to get a tour.
The 2 year anniversary of the 10 year anniversary Our Play tour.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
And
that sounds wonderful.
It would be really quite joyous if we could do a Würzburg stop in that because it was the birthplace of the show. So we will see if that magic happens.
Yep.
I hope it does, and I will be there to witness it.
Okay. Love it.
Thank you for the time and the opportunity to have this really delightful conversation.
That was it. That was the final episode of Making Up with Improv. Thanks so much to Patty and Joe for talking to me. I really had a great time. Guys, that's it. But of course, the Würzburger Impro-Theater Festival, which is the host of this podcast, has many more projects lined up, one of which is the annual Würzburger Impro-Theater Festival, which happens from October 26th to October 30th. And it's a really special one because we're celebrating our 20th birthday. So make sure to sign up for the newsletter on our website to find out when the workshops open so that you can grab a spot. Also, if you're interested in what I'm doing now, you can visit www.schwesterninderüberzahl.de, which is quite hard for someone who's not German. I understand that. I will put it in the show notes. That's my new project with Nadine Antler, and I'm super excited about it. Guys, wherever you are on this planet, I hope you're doing well. I hope you're happy. See you soon.